Brothel started a whole series of reforms, some of them so far advanced that the people didn't have any idea what it was all about. For instance, in the villages in Java, he started individual ownership where they had had desa or village ownership as far back as memory went. But Raffles made a great impression to such an extent that all over the Dutch Indies today, they look back at that short period of British rule as the really golden days and the only decent days of the white man in this whole region. The reforms of Raffles didn't have time to really become established. When the war, the Napoleonic war was over, and the Indies were returned to Holland. Then a system was started. The situation had been so bad under the company that Holland stated, we'll set up a different type of system. We won't have any real taxation here, but all of the natives in the region where spices will grow must plant a certain percentage of their land to export crops, which meant mostly spices, although it applied also to Java. And this system worked. And this so-called culture system brought untold riches to Holland. The wealth of the Indies flowed towards Holland, and as it came, and as the wealth became greater and greater, and more young men went out to work in this region, greater and greater pressure was put, not only on the administrators to get more out of the territory, but pressure was put on the native princelings to serve as the administrators of this reform. And it went so far that in certain bad seasons, bad years, as to lead to near starvation in some regions where the crop failure took place. And more, the native rulers resented the growing power of the Dutch and the wealth of the Indies flowing out, with the result that we had a series of revolts. In Java, in 1825, a revolt took place which lasted until 1830. The Achenese War, which I spoke of a moment ago, beginning in 1873, lasted for 30 years and took practically all the resources that Holland could muster in this part of the world to break. Then the growth of the Liberal Party in Holland, the growth of liberal sentiment, led to very definite changes. And the modern rule of the Dutch in this part of the world changed drastically. They sent into these different districts, into the various courts. They combined most of the courts of Java into smaller units or regencies, but left four major native courts with the semblance of home rule. Out through the districts, they had controllers, and these men were very carefully trained. They had to take, before they could be sent over into this region, they had to take a course in the ethnology of the people, offered either at Utrecht or at the University of Leiden. And they also had to speak the language of the people. And as they went into these districts, they had to make a study of the people and prepare a material as if for publication, or they were subject to dismissal. And the result was that these Dutch controleers knew more about their people than any other people out in this part of the world. In the very center of Borneo, for instance, we found very high-class Dutch controleer who was holding down a territory about five times the size of Holland, and was making a study of the people and getting along very nicely indeed. Despite all that I have been saying about some of the things that were perhaps not to the credit of Holland, there were other things which Holland was doing for the people. For instance, in the last 75 years, they not only tried to have people in here that knew something about the people they were trying to govern, but they protected the natives. You couldn't alienate land. You could lease native land in some places, but they protected the natives from the land being sold out from under them. They encouraged foreign capital to come in to develop such things as quinine, coffee, tobacco, tin, rubber. They invested great sums of money in railroads, in roads, and in the steamship lines. They established schools throughout the villages, particularly in Java, and some schools over in of higher levels. And they also established a very efficient health service in many districts. But during all this period, as the people would get a little more, as they became a bit educated, they would make still greater demands. As the Governor General said to me, as fast as we make grant one request, they make the next. And the growth of nationalism through this district was very evident even 25 or 30 years ago, and it's been constantly growing through this whole region. Well, there were many number of weaknesses in this Dutch rule. First of all, they never attempted to build up allegiance to Holland among the natives. They did attempt to build up a half-breed group, which might be useful to Holland, but so far as the natives were concerned, their loyalty was first of all to their village and then to their native region or to their native state. As the growth of the educated element continued, while there were not many in numbers, quite a number of the present leaders had been educated in Holland or in other European or American universities, and they led the resentment against not only the things that had been done in the past, but against many other things that were happening in the Indies. For instance, we heard repeatedly, even as much as 25 years ago, the leaders of the natives would say, we're not getting a fair return of the wealth which we are producing. And they would say, and it was true, that 4/10 of the population, which the whites constituted, took out 2/3 of the taxable income of the Indians. And the Chinese, who made up 2% of the population, took out 14% more, leaving the 97% of the natives very little. Now, it wasn't quite as bad as it sounds, because this was the taxable income, and the natives did get their living off the land before you reached the taxable income limit. But there was no doubt that the natives were not sharing at all to the extent that most of us would think necessary, and certainly that they thought necessary, in the wealth which they were producing. And so there was a greater and greater demand and a growth of the youth movement and the radical movement, which had nothing to do with communism, but which was a nationalistic movement. Another great problem in here was the population problem. With the better sanitation, better health service, the cutting down of the wars, the population in this part of the world began to mount, and in Java to an unbelievable extent. The little island of Java has a land area of only 50,000 square miles. In 1800, it was estimated it had a population of 3.5 million. Today, it has a population of 46 million, the most densely populated spot on the face of the globe. And the population is increasing at 1% a year. And there just isn't any hope, as long as this population problem is growing, of the very much bettering of conditions. You can't educate the people as fast. You can't open new fields of industry as fast as the population is growing. Well, there was a great deal of unrest. This unrest began many years ago. Then came the war with Japan, and the Japanese moved in, and they encouraged the idea of a free Indonesian state, because they thought that later they could handle that as they pleased. But nevertheless, they encouraged this. And then came the end of the war, and for nearly 4 years, the Japanese were left undisturbed here in the islands. There were no troops to put in. Holland didn't have the troops. The other nations were too busy. And there was practically no real government. And then you had the attempt on the part of some of the leaders to build up a free Indonesia, an Indonesia that would be free of Holland. And you have the appearance of leaders like Sukarno, Syahrir, Hatta, and others, men who were educated in Europe, and nearly all of whom had been isolated or sent into exile by Holland for their disturbance. Now, there's no doubt that by the end of the war, the resentment against the white rule in this part of the world had reached a very high pitch. The memories of the days of Majapahit, when they had their own empire, was brought forward again, and the people could see no reason why they had to have white rulers when they had already had a great empire that had worked. It looked during the war as though a possible scheme would be worked out. The Queen of Holland agreed that at the end of the war, that to this part of the world would be made a free and independent part of the Dutch Commonwealth. This was accepted by such leaders as Syahrir and Sukarno, and it looked as though there was an opportunity to work out some sort of a scheme whereby the Holland would be able to save its great investment in this part of the world and to work with the people. But while the plan looked good, the radicals still stirred up a good deal of trouble. And then you will recall that there was a very foolish attempt on the part of the Dutch to go back into the islands by force. And that immediately antagonized practically all of the elements. And you have a story of war and slaughter, which we know very little about over here. But the number of Dutch, the number of Chinese, the number of mixed bloods, the Indonesians, or the mixed blood Dutch, Malays, the number that were killed and slaughtered through this region is far beyond anything that has been reported in our papers here. Finally, it was agreed between Holland and the Indonesians that they would set up the United States of Indonesia with 16 states. But again, it was charged by the radicals, and perhaps with some truth, that the Dutch were playing politics. And there were always disturbances, always trouble. Until in August of this year, 1950, the Republic of Indonesia was declared. Now, this Republic of Indonesia, once they believed that they had achieved nationalism, the Nationalist Party practically disappeared. And the premier, Hatta, was succeeded by Muhammad Nasir of the Muslim Party. This government that's being set up now is an 18-man coalition government representing the various islands and the various sections of the people. I think we can say this, that the leaders of this Indonesian state, the Republic of Indonesia, are not interested in communism. I think they are definitely against communism. I think that they will resist it as far as possible. But, and of course, the whole Mohammedan faith is definitely antagonistic to Mohammedanism. But, nevertheless, you have here a pretty weak government. There is no native capital. You've got to have outside capital if the people are even going to exist here. You also have this tremendous population problem in Java. 46 million people living here on this little island. The island of Sumatra, as large as the state of California, with perhaps 10 or 11 million. And other states out here, Borneo, the interior, is practically wild. A few years ago, if you went up one of these great rivers and got a half a mile off the river course, you could probably say, I'm the first white man that ever stood here, and you're probably right. The interior was one of the least known sections of the world. And you have the people ranging all the way from the courts of Java, highly civilized people, or the powerful state of Mengen Kabal, which is, I think, today ready for self-government. But you come over here to the head-hunting tribes, the Dayak peoples of Borneo, and I don't think that any stretch of imagination can say that they are ready at present moment for self-government. But these outside districts are tremendously afraid. And unless something has happened to change their opinion very recently, they are almost as antagonistic to Java taking over the rule of this part of the world as they would be for the Dutch or anybody else. There is a lack of unity. There is a lack of an educated middle class. There is a lack of capital. Many of the things which are great weaknesses. Nevertheless, we have here in these Indonesians, who, by the way, in setting up their new Republic of Indonesia, have almost copied the Constitution of the United States and have taken over our idea. We have people here that we can work with. And this is one of the bright possibilities in the present crisis, which I'm going to touch on in just a moment. Well, there is another serious threat that you probably have seen in the papers in the last days. This new government, which is hardly established as yet, is now demanding that the Dutch give up their holdings in New Guinea and turn it over to this Indonesian government. Now, New Guinea is not populated by Malays. It's populated by Papuan and other Negro peoples. It has nothing in common except that this was all under the control of Holland at one time. And they are demanding that if this is not turned over to the Republic of Indonesia by the end of this year, that very drastic steps will be taken. Well, there are plenty of opportunities for trouble here, I think you can see. A word about the British Malaya. When the British came in here, they established themselves under Raffles at Singapore, later at Malacca, at Penang, and some little points called the Ding Dings. And this is all the land that Great Britain has ever claimed as they actually own in this region. In the rest of the peninsula, there are 9 native states, with each with its native Mohammedan rulers, and with a course which goes back to the days of Indian influence. When the British came in here to establish themselves, they were again after trade, and they made certain contracts with these native rulers that they would not exploit the land, they would not alienate the land, and but that they would assist them in various ways, and particularly in the development of the country. This was carried on at first under the British East India Company, but in 1867, their rule was turned over to the Crown. And this excited the suspicion of the native rulers tremendously, because they thought it meant that Great Britain was getting ready to move in and take over. Also, there were many causes for friction. The piracy which I had mentioned was rampant along this coast, and British boats, like other boats, fell prey to the pirates. Altogether, the causes of friction were sufficiently great so that in 1874, the British compelled each one of these native states to accept a British resident in the court, and he was to act as elder brother or advisor to the Sultan. But since the Sultan had to take his advice, it gave the British a considerable amount of influence in each court.